Hey everyone, welcome to Just Mental Health with Steph and Em, the podcast where we discuss mental health issues from a social justice lens. I'm Emily.
And I'm Stephanie. A quick disclaimer before we get started. We are mental health professionals, but this is not to be taken as professional advice.
We are also aware that our privilege may cloud our perspective on some topics, and we not only welcome but encourage you to message us with criticism and correction. Let's get started. So we have started to have a business of the week, paying close attention to women and minority-owned businesses. So our first business that we want to highlight this week, a fellow therapist of ours, fellow Chicago therapist of mine, they are called Pivot. And they are located in the Ravenswood neighborhood of Chicago. They specialize in trauma and other life adversities. Learning how to pivot after trauma and other life adversities. That's a really clever slogan. Mm-hmm. So they do individual and group therapy. Individual is either virtual or in person, and group therapy is all virtual. They are trained in a lot of different evidence-based models. Acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, EMDR, cognitive processing therapy, prolonged exposure. And they have a website, pivotpsychchicago.org. So if you are looking for, looks like soon they'll also be doing supervision and consultation, training, and speaking. So if you're looking for any of those services, please reach out to them. And now let's go ahead and get started on our topic for today. Stephanie, you want to take it away?
Yeah. So today the topic is we're going to talk about two different psychological, mental health, terms, mm-hmm. And how they could have origins in sexism and misogyny. So the first one that we're going to talk about is Stockholm syndrome, which I'm really excited about because how this happened was I saw a Facebook post, and I don't believe everything that I read on Facebook, but I was reading it and I was like, wait, I never knew this. I had no idea that this was a thing. Pretty much what the post said was that Stockholm syndrome is rooted in misogyny and was sort of made up without any real evidence to discredit female survivors of abuse or trauma.
Really? I thought it was a real thing.
No. I thought it was too until I read this post. And I was like, okay, I have to look into this. I have to, check this out. And if you Google Stockholm syndrome or Stockholm syndrome debunked or Stockholm syndrome myth, which is what I did to find this stuff, there's not a lot out there about how this actually came about. There's a lot out there from sources that I would consider pretty credible, like Psychology Today and some scientific journals, about sort of the accuracy of the term Stockholm syndrome, and or also known as trauma bonding, which is what a lot of people are calling it now. It's sort of one of those pop psychology, armchair psychology terms that can get really popular every so often. Everybody uses them for everything. But when you actually look into it, it's not rooted in any real science or in anything evidence-based. So I'm just going to read a little bit about the myth of Stockholm syndrome.
Define Stockholm's. We should probably define it in case anyone doesn't actually know what it is.
Oh yeah. I was going to. So. So Stockholm syndrome is where survivors of kidnapping kind of align with and sympathize with their captors. That's where it started.
And like in Beauty of the Beauty.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's often brought up for that.
Yeah.
And the thing that's weird about it is that it's, at least according to the Stockholm Syndrome sort of theory, is that these survivors will actually protect or defend their captors. They align with them. They feel close to them. They may even fall in love with them. And they don't take opportunity to get out or escape, even when that's there. So, yeah, this is really big in popular culture. There's lots of movies about it. There's songs, so many songs about Stockholm Syndrome, like that's the name of them. And so how it actually, this is the story of where it came from, and then I'll tell you sort of like the real story, as they're saying. So it happened in, and I'm going to butcher this word probably, Normalstorg, Sweden, there was a bank robbery and a hostage situation. And it was in 1973. Jan Erik Olsen was a convicted criminal who had disappeared while on furlough from prison and then held up a bank and took four hostages. During the ensuing negotiations, Swedish Minister of Justice Lennart Geijer, I don't know how to say his name, allowed Olsen's former cellmate and friend Clark to be brought from prison to the bank. So famously, the hostages then bonded with their captors and acted to protect them despite their repeated threats to kill them all. Police finally mounted a tear gas attack 5 days into the crisis, and the robbers surrendered. So that's where that term came from, was that the sort of strange phenomenon of these captors or these captees aligning with their captors. And everyone was like, why would they do that? That doesn't make any sense. That's weird. It's got to be this new syndrome that this guy came up with. So it, what really happened, and I'll just read you this a little bit and then we'll get into talking about it. But Stockholm Syndrome was invented in 1973 after a hostage taking at the bank. One of the hostages, Kristen Enmark, criticized police and government responses as dangerous and disorganized and aligned tactically with the hostage takers. After the hostage taking, Kristen became the first person said to have Stockholm Syndrome, a new label invented just for the occasion. Since then, Stockholm Syndrome has become a received truth, a concept that both reflects and upholds the habits of finding pathologies in the minds of victims of violence, particularly women. Oddly, the psychiatrist who coined the term Stockholm Syndrome never spoke with Kristen Enmark. Neither have present-day experts who present misinformation and perpetuate the myth. So the police psychologists came up with this literally from this one event, never interviewed the woman who it came from, and there's no like evidence for this. It's really a theory. So when from her point of view, like when you hear her talking about it later, as she you know, after everything was sort of over, she talked about it. And her thing was mostly that she disagreed with how the police were handling the situation. She felt that they were making things worse and putting more people in danger. from what they were. So she was really critical of the government and the police. And,
but it's not like she was defending the,
yeah,
she was.
Well, that's where it gets a little weird. So like, I guess there was supposedly a romantic relationship between her and the guy that took them captive. But I don't really know about that part as much, because mostly for me, the thing that I think is interesting is just that someone who's supposed to be like a scientific person, you know, would just come up with this theory without interviewing the person. Mm-hmm. And then it just sort of like takes off, and it's just kind of slapped on as a label for kidnapping victims, women in abusive relationships, so stuff like that. And the problem is, it's just not as clear cut as that.
Mm-hmm.
Stockholm syndrome is very, very rare, even just according to the people that, you know, they don't diagnose it, but according to the FBI, you know, when they keep track of this stuff,
mm-hmm.
anyone having Stockholm syndrome from a situation, it's very, very rare. And it's almost always, always applied to women. Mm-hmm. So a lot of like people that, so like children that were kidnapped at a young age, and then years later, you know, they were found or whatever. They'll sort of apply it to that. Like they bonded with their captors. Like Elizabeth Smart, you remember that case?
Mm-hmm.
She's one that some, you know, people have come out and said that she had Stockholm syndrome because she didn't try to run away at every opportunity that was given to her. But when you hear her talk about it, she says that it was not Stockholm syndrome. It was not because she aligned with them or felt sorry for them. It was because she was terrified.
Yeah. So that's what I've been thinking as I'm listening mm-hmm. to you, that I think the Stockholm syndrome is like a syndrome, like something that you like get, that you would mm-hmm. get like diagnosed with or whatever. That's not a real thing. It's more or so a trauma response.
Yeah.
You know, like you, so there's, I mean, there's like, people know about fight, but there's also fight, flight, freeze, and fawn.
Mm-hmm.
And going along with what your captor, perpetrator is doing or asking you to do is fawning, you know, mm-hmm. kind of like feeling like you've lost all control and going along with what they're doing in order to protect yourself, because if you retaliate, it can make things worse. Like that's the concept, and that's what happens, and that's
yes.
a trauma response. It's not Stockholm syndrome.
Right. That's what the argument is that mm-hmm. what is being labeled as Stockholm syndrome is just not an accurate picture of what's happening, that it is more of a survival technique. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're trying to reduce the amount of harm that is inflicted upon you, or you're trying to stay alive in a situation and you're fawning, like you said, or you're making decisions of like, I'm going to be nice to this person. I'm going to be understanding and sympathetic, whatever. I'm going to comply. It's because you're trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk to people that have been through that, or women that have survived domestic violence situations, that's a lot of what they say is, I was trying to survive.
Right.
The other part of it is that it doesn't take into account, if you're just saying, oh, it's Stockholm syndrome, especially when we're talking about like domestic violence situations, you know, well, why doesn't she leave? Well, Stockholm syndrome doesn't take into account the manipulation and the gaslighting and the sort of brainwashing that can happen in mm-hmm. intimate partner violence, or for children that are being abused by their caretaker or their parent, like what other choice do they have but to align with their, you know, caregiver? So,
and it, with children, sorry to cut you
no,
off.
You go ahead.
With children, it's even different because they don't know any better. You know, I mean, not to say like that sounded blaming of adults, but that's not how I meant it. I'm, you know, like children are, children don't even, children just have less knowledge about people and what relate, what relationships are appropriate and inappropriate anyway. And it is common for kids who are abused to have positive feelings toward their abuser because they don't know that it's abuse, mm-hmm. you know, and they've been groomed and their abuser is giving them all of these, you know, telling them all of these seemingly positive things that a child doesn't know to not see it for what it, for what they're saying.
Right. Right. And that's, that goes back to the, like, you said grooming, but also like brainwashing and gaslighting and just all of the manipulation tactics that come with the abusive, toxic relationship cycle. And we don't have like a whole lot of time to go into that, but I mean, you know, the cycle that's typically talked about is sort of that honeymoon phase. In the beginning, or the where there's like love bombing, where they're showering you with gifts or attention and affection and praise, and they're just, you know, like the knight in shining armor, sort of this perfect person, this perfect partner. Mm-hmm. And then sort of once they get you hooked, you know, they get you to fall in love with them, pretty much. Then the manipulation starts, and
the falling in love came first.
Yes,
that's what's different about Stockholm syndrome. You know, like they fall in love and then they abuse you. Versus Stockholm syndrome, they abuse you or kidnap you, and then
exactly. So that's why you can't, you know, Stockholm syndrome can't be applied in those situations because Stockholm syndrome is with, you know, it has to happen with. Strangers, people you didn't know before that are taking you captive. I mean, that's, you know, how it was outlined in the beginning. And, but even then, you know, it's aligning with your captor. They're a complete stranger, sort of not helping or not trying to escape or leave or get free or whatever, not fighting back, all of those things, like, and then sort of defending the captor are all the defining characteristics of Stockholm syndrome. But again, it's sort of this blanket term to put on of like, we don't understand why this person would do this. So it's got to be this weird psychological phenomenon. And really though, when you are looking in like, as far as trauma goes, it makes sense. Like you said, that in that moment, they're just trying to survive. So what critics of Stockholm syndrome are saying is that it was a myth invented to discredit women victims of violence. Mm-hmm. It not only discredits them, it obscures their resistance to violence. So it says that, you know, women or victims are not resisting. They're just like, freely going along with that, which is not accurate either, because even if someone isn't physically resisting, it doesn't mean that they're not like mentally or emotionally resisting in some way. You know, kids may not be able to go against their parents, or a female victim may not be able to go against like a male perpetrator just because of like anatomy, maybe he's stronger or whatever. But that doesn't mean that they're not internally resisting. So it's it's misogynistic in that way. And then it also, it shifts the focus away from the actual events that happen to the pathologies in the minds of the victim. So it's victim blaming.
Mm-hmm.
It's not saying, okay, this person took you captive and you were terrified and afraid. It's saying you developed a abnormal relationship with them. And that's weird, you know? And then,
that's what I was going to say is it's like, whenever I think of, like, when I hear the term Stockholm syndrome, I think like helpless woman. That's the image that like pops into my mind. And I mean, it certainly makes sense the way that you're describing it as misogynistic, because that's clearly not what happens.
Yeah. Because every sort of case that they have said, this could be a case of Stockholm syndrome in the media, it's been a female victim. And in the movies, in, you know, the media, it's always a female victim. So it is really just oh, I can't think of words today. This is bad. It's like just really gendered, which it doesn't really make sense that it would need to be. And so Stockholm syndrome has kind of led into other sort of ideas, like I said before, like trauma bonding or learned helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
Or what they used to say, battered women's syndrome, internalized depression, stuff like that, which really is just all of it is victim blaming. And instead of just looking at it as someone trying to survive and as being a very clever way of surviving when you think about it, that it's sort of blaming them, like, you should have done this. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you escape? Why didn't you resist?
Yeah.
You know, and it just, that sort of thinking goes all the way back to, why did you walk home alone? You know, why did you walk to your car alone? Why were you wearing that skirt? Why did you have so many drinks? Like,
it sounds like the concept, So the Stockholm, it's like the connotation that's associated with it, I feel like. Like, it just has this, like, oh, she has Stockholm. You know, like, it has this kind of, but when you do look at it as a trauma response, and even a post-trauma response, you know, because sometimes you will hear victims sort of, like, I wouldn't call it defending, but saying things like, no, that couldn't have been what happened because I don't think he knew what he was doing. I don't think he realized it was wrong, or I shouldn't have been doing this. I shouldn't have been doing that. And the reason that victims respond that way shortly after their trauma is because their brain is not ready to process what happened. You know,
that becomes a defense mechanism.
Right. They're in this state of denial, because who wants to accept that something like that happened to them? Who wants to accept that someone had that power over them to harm them in this way? But again, that's a trauma response. And then after they have processed it and they, you know, maybe have been in therapy for a while, they realize, okay, no, like, this was not my fault. This was 100% their fault. But I think it stems from just a really, we just do not understand trauma responses. Like, we assume that everyone is able to think rationally before, during, and after their trauma.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make any sense, because did you think rationally when, like, did I think rationally, like, last week before we recorded, when I ate the entire pint of ice cream? We were on the phone and I ate the entire pint of ice cream. Was I thinking rationally? No. Was I thinking about all the sugar I was consuming? No. I was thinking, this is right in front of me. It tastes really good, so I'm eating it. That's all I was thinking. You know?
Yeah.
And then, like,
yeah.
Later, you rationally think about it and you're like, maybe that wasn't the best choice for my health.
Right.
You know? And, like,
right. So, and that's finally, a small example.
And that's a small example.
Like,
right.
So imagine being in a life or death situation.
Right. I mean, and why do
never, we. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Why do we. why do we accept that that's a, that not thinking rationally is acceptable in those situations, but then when it is a life or death situation, like you're saying, all of that goes, suddenly goes out the window. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. Cause so like, just on more of a practical, mm-hmm. you know, place, like working with trauma survivors and people with PTSD, you know, it, trying to explain to them how in the moment, in a life or death situation, you have got to make choices very, very fast. And your brain does it for you and your body does it for you automatically. That is a thing that was evolved. That is a survival skill. It is adaptive. Like your reptilian brain makes these decisions. It's like you're spinning the wheel and you get no control over what it lands on, fight, mm-hmm. flight, fawn, or freeze. But later, when you're able to be rational and process, that's just hindsight, right? You're able to look back and be like, well, why didn't I do that? Well, I should have done that. I should have mm-hmm. seen that coming, blah, blah, blah. But that's just because you know now what you didn't know in the moment. If you've never had a gun held to your head, you know, or if you've never been chased by a bear, or if you've never had the thought, is this person going to kill me? Then how can you know how you're going to react right. in a situation? You don't. And I think if you don't understand it, you're lucky because you've never been in a life or death situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, who are we to say what someone should or shouldn't have done? Right. In a situation like that, even just like driving a car, right? Like, so I'm driving and there's a lot of deer where I live and they'll just run out in front of the road because I don't know, deer do that. It's annoying. And you don't see them until they're right there in front of your car. And then you've got to make a decision. Do I hit the deer? Do I stop? Do I run off the road? Like if I'm going too fast and I can't, you're making all these decisions really quickly.
And it's not even a decision really. It's whatever your body does.
Yeah. I mean, it's honestly. A reflex. You're right. Yeah. yeah. But like something's making those decisions.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
not aware of it. And most of the time I end up like slowing down and swerving to try to miss them. But like, if there was a car in the lane next to me or a car behind me, they would crash into me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would be like, oh, why did I do that? Why did I not just hit the deer? You know, but then if I hit the deer, then later I'd be like, why did I hit the deer? I didn't have to kill it. Like I didn't have to. So there's almost like no win right. in a situation like that. It's just, you just are trying to survive. So, you know, the other thing, one last thing about Stockholm mm-hmm. syndrome, and then we'll wrap up about it. And I really suggest that, like, if anyone's interested in this, then they should do more research on it. And I'll give you a couple of books that you can look into, because there's not a lot of studies out there that really give any sort of conclusive evidence. One, because Stockholm syndrome is not a diagnosis. It's not in the DSM.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's ever been.
Wait, do you want to say what the DSM
is? Oh, yeah. The Diagnostic Statistics Manual.
It's a book of, it's a manual that has like all the criteria to be diagnosed with a mental yeah. disorder.
It's often called like, you know, the therapist Bible. Like if it's not mm-hmm. in the DSM, it doesn't exist, which is not mm-hmm. true. That's another topic. But because it's not in the DSM, you can't be diagnosed with it. There's no real clear-cut outline of what Stockholm syndrome is or what it takes to be, to have that, other than just identifying with your captor and
mm-hmm.
not trying to, you know, outwardly resist or escape. Those are really the only things. And it's also really hard to replicate something like that in order to study it. They've tried to study it. But, you know, the participants know that it's not a life or death situation. They know they're mm-hmm. in a study.
Yeah.
So if you were really to put people in a life or death situation like that to study, it would be unethical. So you can't, you have to study these things after they happen There's no real controlled environment for that.
It's so interesting the way it sounds like this one situation in 1973 mm-hmm. just started this whole thing mm-hmm. that now is accepted as fact.
Yes, and that's the thing.
No evidence for it, yeah.
That's the thing. It's accepted as a fact because it's become pop psychology. It's become a term.
Pop psychology, yeah.
Yeah, that's gotten used a lot. And when you look at it, you're like, there's just hardly any evidence to suggest at all that this is a thing. And so why are we even running with this? It's not really trauma-informed. It's not informed with anything. So if you are interested in learning any more about Stockholm Syndrome, there's two books that you could probably read. So The Myth of Stockholm Syndrome and Other Concepts Invented to Discredit Women Victims of Violence, and that's by Dr. Alan Wade. And then the other one that is really good is See What You Made Me Do, Power, Control, and Domestic Violence by Jess Hill. And they both talk about exactly what we just talked about, how Stockholm Syndrome is misogynistic and is used to discredit women. So you can look those up if you want to learn more. Also, just in addition, something that might be interesting. So like, what's the opposite of Stockholm Syndrome? Do you know?
Are you quizzing me?
Yeah.
What's the opposite of Stockholm Syndrome?
You don't know because nobody knows.
Know. Yeah.
Because like you never use it. But there's Stockholm Syndrome, which is like identifying with your captor. Then there's mm-hmm. London Syndrome, which is like the complete opposite because apparently there was another bank robbery hostage situation in London at another time where all of the captees fought back constantly against mm-hmm. their captor. So it was like the opposite of those situations. And so that's been coined as London Syndrome.
And of course the one that took off and spread was the one where the
yeah.
woman is helpless and the one that was meant to discredit her.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting because I've never heard of that. I've never heard of London Syndrome.
Yeah. Or often called, there's also Lima Syndrome, which is like the same thing. Another thing that had happened in Lima, Peru. So, I mean, you know, you look at these pockets of interesting things that have happened and you want to understand the psychology behind them. But if you're looking at it with the lens of, you know, misogyny or racism
the one that
or
happened
anything
in
like that.
The huh? Lima syndrome was the similar to what happened in London?
Yeah, it's just, yeah.
Okay.
There's different names. Like Stockholm syndrome is sometimes also referred to as Helsinki syndrome, which like that's just, it's the same thing, but Stockholm mm-hmm. syndrome got popular. You know, it's...
Just pick any city that this
just
happened
whatever.
In.
Just whatever. Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, you could
we make a syndrome for eating a pint of ice cream. Like
you
Chicago
could
syndrome. Like
you could make a syndrome for anything.
Yeah,
like clearly it doesn't have to be based on anything. But yeah, so just thought that was interesting.
That was really interesting.
Encourage people to do more research and to just look into these popular terms in psychology and, you know, before you go around and just use them, which therapists and mental health professionals are guilty of this too. Like we need to educate ourselves on where these come from and what they mean and if they're based in any sort of evidence or reality.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So what did you have?
Stephanie, so I want to talk a bit about borderline personality disorder. So this one mm-hmm. is different than Stockholm Syndrome because it is in the DSM, but like you said, the DSM is not the end-all be-all of mental health disorders. It has its own fair share of misogyny.
Yeah.
So I was doing some reading. So the whole like discrediting women, like calling women crazy, calling women hysterical, the Hippocrates, I want to go back a very long time. he was a, like the first that used the term hysteria, mm-hmm. which he said was for women who like didn't have enough sex. And that the way to fix that would be have more sex with your husband. So just another way of like controlling women's sexuality, you know, discrediting women's emotions. And so that's, you know, that idea obviously has, you know, progressed slightly, but now we've landed on borderline personality disorder. So I read this, it's a blog post by Quinn Capes Ivey, Borderline Personality Disorder, A Feminist Critique. It's on this page called The F Word, Contemporary UK Feminism. So I wanted to make sure I was giving mm-hmm. her credit for this. So this is actually from 2010, and the DSM-5 came out in 2013. So mm-hmm. she is going by
the DSM-4.
an older definition, but I don't think it's changed drastically. So she has been, well, it's known in the UK as emotionally unstable personality disorder, but because they use something, a different book in Europe. They didn't use it
probably,
but it's the same thing. And she's writing about how she believes that for herself it is accurate, but after reading about it, learning about it, you know, experiencing herself, she sees that it really does have a lot of misogynistic pieces to it, that 3/4 of people who are diagnosed with borderline are women, and why that is. And so she talks about how the criteria are all things that are expected of men and not shamed in men. But for women, they're called hysterical, they're called crazy, they're called overly emotional. So
what are the criteria? I said, what are the criteria?
Yeah, so I'll read through them. So chronic feelings of emptiness. Okay, well, so 5 or more of the following. Chronic feelings of emptiness, emotional instability in reaction to day-to-day events, such as intense episodic sadness, irritability, or anxiety, usually lasting a few hours and only rarely more than a few days. Frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. Identity disturbance with markedly or persistently unstable self-image or sense of self. Impulsive behavior in at least 2 areas that are potentially self-damaging, such as spending, sex, substance abuse, reckless driving, binge eating, inappropriate intense anger or difficulty controlling anger, such as frequent displays of temper, constant anger, recurrent physical fights, pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships characterized by extremes between idealization and devaluation, also known as splitting, recurrent suicidal behavior, gestures or threats or self-harming behavior, transient stress-related paranoid ideation or severe dissociative symptoms. So I guess we didn't really define it, but overall, I mean, that defined it pretty much, but overall it's like a very deep, intense fear of abandonment.
And then behaviors sort of stemming from that. Yeah.
Right.
One thing I was going to ask, so, cause I don't remember, does it say how long it has to be present for in order to be diagnosed? Just wondering. Or if there's like an age.
I don't have the actual, I just have a site that lists, I don't have the actual DSM.
Okay. Yeah. I don't remember. Well, I only bring that up because don't self-diagnose yourself, people. Cause like when I read stuff like that, you know, on any given day, I probably fit that criteria.
Right.
But it's not just like, oh, I sometimes do that. Or I have days where I'm, you know, I have these sort of behaviors mm-hmm. and symptoms. It's a lot more than that. It's got to be like persistent.
Yeah.
It's usually got to be like, you have to be like before or after, you know, a certain age. It has to be present for a certain period of time. And it has to be, you know, a consistent thing. And if it's a personality mm-hmm. disorder, like borderline personality disorder is, it has to be present for most of this person's life in every aspect without, usually it says like the caveat is like not, while they're under, you know, substance use or something. Mm-hmm. So like it can't be only present when you drink.
Right.
That would be different. Or it can't be caused by like medication or some other, medical thing. It has to just be like on its own. So
mm-hmm. yeah, thank you for saying that. 'Cause that's a good point that a lot of times you say like a deep sense of abandonment and then people are like, oh my God, I have a fear of abandonment.
Yeah. Right.
Like that's not, yeah. Like not that that's not valid and you know, that's yeah. something to that people struggle with, but it's, yeah, it's to the point where it's like impeding on your life and it yeah. is such a, like a core
and all your relationships.
Yeah.
And not just because like you're having a bad day or you're feeling insecure for some reason or whatever. Because like I said, on any given day, I probably hit some of those. Like, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of that can be relatable to some people. But
there's a book I haven't read the book, but I think the title explains it well. It's called "I Hate You, Don't Leave Me."
Yes. Yeah.
Have you read it?
Yeah, I have it on my bookshelf.
Oh, yeah. I always recommend and mention books that I haven't actually read. But
but like other people have read and told me.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that just that title explains it well. I hate you. Like that is the sabotaging relationships piece, but don't leave me. That's the fear of abandonment piece. So it's like you have such an intense, deep fear of abandonment that you sabotage your relationship in an effort to not get hurt. But mm-hmm. then that causes you, leads to you feeling right. abandoned. So that you're like, don't leave me.
It's a confirmation. Yeah.
So an overview of borderline, but a lot of these, so for example, impulsive behavior in at least two areas, potentially self-damaging, spending, sex, substance abuse, reckless driving, binge eating. So mm-hmm. impulsive behavior is much more socially acceptable in men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, men have a lot of sex versus a woman having a lot of sex. Not, and this isn't even saying a lot of sex. This is saying reckless. So like a lot of unsafe sex.
Right, right. It's not just somebody that has a lot of sex. It's somebody that has sex where like unprotected or with people they don't know or just
or as a way of sabotaging a relationship. So right. like they're in a monogamous relationship and they
yeah, a lot of infidelity partner. Or something. Yeah. yeah.
So those things are all, you know, seen by society as more common
mm-hmm.
in men and yeah. they're aimed in women. Inappropriate, intense anger, difficulty controlling anger. Anger mm-hmm. is much more socially acceptable in women. I mean, in men,
mm-hmm.
Women who are very angry are more likely to be pathologized. They're seen as hysterical. They're seen as crazy. They're seen as like, wow, yeah. she's like that crazy bitch, you know, if right. she's has a lot of really intense anger. Seeing if anything else jumps out at me. Emotional instability and reaction. So I think because women are like men are socialized to only show anger mm-hmm. and not show mm-hmm. You know, the sadness or vulnerability, like fear.
Any other emotion.
Right, yeah. Just
kidding, but not really.
Whereas women do normally. And so
yeah.
it's seen as, women being emotional is seen as, okay, sorry. I'm having trouble getting my thoughts together.
So, I was too. What is going on?
Okay, so the fact that women are more likely to show a wider array of emotion, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It's going to cause them to be more likely diagnosed with borderline.
Yes.
And then there was a paragraph in this post that I wanted, in this
mm-hmm.
British woman's post I wanted to read. Okay. I've been wondering whether borderline personality disorder is a mental illness/personality disorder at all. Considering so many more women are diagnosed with it than men, and considering it's thought to develop in early childhood rather than being an innate mental illness, could there be something about being raised female which increases women's propensity towards borderline type thinking? Could that, quote, inappropriate anger be not a disordered way of thinking, but a valid female rage against a world which devalues women and things which are thought of as, quote, traditionally feminine? Mm. So, quick thing I want to point out about that, when she says, considering it's thought to develop in early childhood rather than being an innate mental illness, that doesn't really matter because there's a lot of real mental illnesses that mm-hmm. are not innate. PTSD, for example, you're mm-hmm. not born with PTSD, you develop it if you experience trauma. Other than that part, I think there's a lot of truth to this. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we just devalue women's anger, even though it's usually pretty valid based on the way, you know, our misogynistic patriarchal culture.
Yeah, definitely. And kind of along with that, like you were saying about, you know, PTSD is the disorder that comes from trauma, but there's a lot more thinking out there now that borderline is a trauma response. You know, if somebody has borderline personality disorder as a diagnosis, then it's really a trauma response. It develops in early childhood, and it's typically, actually, I think always, I don't know of anyone who's been diagnosed with it that doesn't have trauma in mm-hmm. their childhood. So, you know, it's a lot of like very stressful situations or being emotionally, physically, or sexually abused, having a neglectful parent, growing up with a family member who has a serious mental health condition or a substance use issue, mm-hmm. or having a parent that has another personality disorder, have all been sort of cited as factors that can cause people to be more likely to develop borderline personality right. disorder. So if you're looking at it as a trauma response, being, you know, trauma informed, then it could be just sort of another manifestation mm-hmm. of part of PTSD or an attachment, you know, disorder. And not so much a personality disorder. I don't mm-hmm. know. It's just interesting that we see those things come from trauma. And right. then again, women are being sort of blamed for their responses to these trauma. It's not mm-hmm. something awful happened to you in childhood, and this is how you have adapted and developed because of it.
Your very valid response to it.
Yeah.
Understandable response to it. And then that response has a label placed on it.
Yeah. It's you have a personality disorder.
Right. Borderline, even in the mental health professionals, even among mental health professionals, there is so much stigma on borderline.
Oh, like, gosh, yeah.
If someone says, oh, I have a client with borderline, it's like, oh my God, you have a client with borderline. I'm so sorry. That must really suck. Like, people just, even yeah. in the mental health community, like really shame people with borderline. And
yeah, and, it's sad. I mean,
okay, fine. Maybe they're difficult clients, but like the way that I've heard some of our colleagues talking about it, it really bothers me. I mean, if you don't feel fit to work with them, then fine, refer them to someone else, but don't like,
right.
don't like shame them for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Cause I mean, yeah, so they might be a difficult client, but like so is lots of other,
yeah,
you know, diagnoses. And there's something for everyone. If you're not into treating personality disorders, if you don't enjoy that, then don't take those. I personally am not a fan. I just don't enjoy treating like substance use disorders. It's just not my thing. That's one of mm-hmm. those things that like people love it or they just don't.
Yeah.
I'd rather do, you know, trauma or relationship stuff or whatever. But So I just try not to take, sometimes you have to, but I try my best to not take clients where substance use is the main focus. It's not, if it, if they have trauma and substance use is sort of has come from that, then that's different. But if it's, you know, if that's the main issue, I'm not the therapist for them. And for a lot of people, if you cannot handle personality disorders, and how they present and the issues that, that come with that, then you just need to, like you said, refer them out, not take them, instead of continuing to shame or stigmatize them. Because again, this population comes from trauma. They've already been through it. Right. They don't need the person that they're coming to for help.
And it is
further shame them.
It's tricky though to shaming them, period. Like that doesn't shouldn't happen. But it is tricky to, because it takes a while to diagnose a personality disorder. And then sometimes it's already when they've developed a relationship with their therapist. And then it's like, you know, I think I'm going to diagnose you with borderline personality disorder, and I'm not trained in working with personality disorder, so I need to refer you to someone else. Then it's another abandonment. Then they're
going to. That's true. Good point. Yeah.
And I feel like among mental health professionals, personality disorders are the only ones. I don't know. I feel like I don't hear therapists shaming other disorders as much as they do personality disorders. And it really bothers me.
I can see. Yeah.
We should be doing better as professionals.
Absolutely. And just the way we talk about it in our vernacular, you know, don't say, oh, that person has a personality disorder. That person is borderline. That person is a narcissist, which I hear a lot. I hear narcissist thrown around a lot. It's like, just because they're an asshole doesn't mean they're a narcissist, you know, like doesn't mean they have a personality disorder. Those are different things. Please stop just making people with personality disorders out to be complete assholes. They're difficult and they're pervasive, and, you know, whether or not it's rooted in misogyny, you know, which it probably certainly is, it's still an issue. There's still something going on with people that have this diagnosis, and they still need treatment and mental health, resources, and they need support.
Yeah. And
more than ever, I think probably this population needs people that are solid, that are understanding and can set really good boundaries, but still respect and care about that person in some way. So that they, that sense of abandonment is not constantly reinforced.
One more point I want to make on this real quick. She says in this post, in an ideal world, women would not be seen as the quote other, and our natural behaviors would not be seen as deviant. So I think that's a really good point, that we see the way that, whether it's the way men are naturally or the way that society has decided men are, that is seen as the norm, like that's seen as the standard, that's seen as the norm, and anything else is seen as the other or the deviant, the, you know, people that are being deviant of the norm. And then those are the ones that get pathologized. And we also have to look at how this affects men, because that puts so many men who may have this disorder who are not getting treated.
Yeah, yeah.
And then on top of that, you have just the stigma of mental illness, which is higher for men than women. And that's a piece of why a lot of these mental illnesses, it is reported that women have them more, because women are more likely to seek help.
Right.
But we have to open up, like give men room to, we can't see it as men are this way, women are this way, because it leaves men, it, it overdiagnoses women and it underdiagnoses men.
Yes.
Because there are men, I'm sure there are plenty of men that have borderline personality disorder and their behaviors are not pathologized because it's seen as normal for men. And then they're not getting the help they need. And it's
right. Really sad for them. And they don't have a space to, you know, say, yeah, this is, you know, like when it comes to advocacy or like, you know, a lot of people that have mental health diagnoses kind of have like their own sort of like group, right? Of like mm-hmm. with a support system online or a support group, you know, face to face, which like nobody's doing that anymore. But, you know, sort of like I suffer from depression and this is what depression is like for me, you know, and men with borderline can't always just be like, either they're not diagnosed or they are diagnosed. And the stigma, because it's like a woman's, you know, disorder.
No one can see your air quotes. She did an air quote.
I'm not like trying to like, I'm just saying no, that, you know, but you know, because it is, seen as a mm-hmm. female sort of thing, then men, you know, they can't just be like, oh, I have borderline and this is how it affects me. And this is, mm-hmm. you know, they're not able to talk about it as much. And it can also be stigmatized in that maybe if, you know, the man is very emotional or, you know, has a lot of relationships that come and go very quickly because of their, you know, fear of abandonment or, you know, has these sort of these mood swings or whatever, then it's typically, you know, they're typically sort of shamed for that as being like more feminine, mm-hmm. or, you know, more like a woman, like, oh, you've got, you know, are you PMSing is like heard a lot or like, why are you being so emotional? Like just man up or just tough it out or whatever. And so then that isolates men from getting help too. So, I mean, you know, this is the thing about like feminism or how it should, you know, how it should be is if it's a woman's mm-hmm. issue, it is also a man's issue in some way. It is everyone's issue.
Yeah. I we were just talking about this. I couldn't imagine, you know, I mean, I think that there's plenty of things about being a woman that I could do without, for sure, to say the least. But I couldn't imagine just feeling like my emotional expression is like put in this little box. And it's like you're only allowed to express these certain emotions. And if you express these emotions, then you're seen as weak. And mm-hmm. I mean, of course, like we've said, if women express those emotions, they're seen as crazy. But like,
yeah,
still, there's still more room for women to express emotions than men, and
it's more forgiven in
women. And that's a piece of feminism, and it really needs to, you know, we do need to talk about how the patriarchy negatively affects men too.
And okay, one last thing I just thought of this, mm-hmm. like I was actually talking to a client the other day, and pretty much what the whole thing boils down to was we were discussing how like there's lots of groups for women, mental health groups, support mm-hmm. groups for women, because women go to them. But yeah. if you had a support group or a mental health group that was just for men, nobody would show up.
Yeah.
And,
unless it's court ordered.
Yes. Unless it's court ordered or it's, it has religious undertones. So like, because that's kind of what we were talking about was like religion, can give men that sense of like having a group and being able to like, they can go to other men and talk to them about things. You know, they might have like a Bible study or a worship group or something that's just for men about men's issues. And that is kind of a way for men to have that connection that women get a lot of times with their friends, their mm-hmm. group of friends that men don't have socially. And so when it's like court ordered or it involves religion, yeah, you'll see men there. But if it's like a voluntary, like, let's have a support group for male survivors of trauma, nobody's showing up. And that's really sad.
It is, yeah.
That's why, you know, there's the suicide rate among men are so high.
Mm-hmm. I think also, I know we're trying to wrap up.
We're going
to
wrap up. But, yeah.
But real quick. So I was wanting to start a group for men, mm-hmm. but I was talking to a few people. I'm like, do you think men would come to a therapy group that's led by a woman? And most of them said, like, people that, you know, I consulted with about this were like, well, I think men feel more comfortable going to a group that's led mm-hmm. by a man. But most therapists are women, which is also a piece of the issue, is that, like, women are socialized to be more nurturing and more empathetic. And so, like, women end up becoming therapists, and then they end up starting groups for women who, you know, and this is like a cycle.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think they're right. I think men would rather go to a group led by a man, but at least in my experience, and I have no real evidence behind this except my personal experience. My male clients, I've like really got a niche now with like mm-hmm. male trauma victims. And it's like, I'm getting a lot of that. And I like it because it's just a totally different representation of working with women with trauma. But I'm getting a lot of male clients, and they're saying like, I am more comfortable talking to you because you mm-hmm. are a woman. If you were a man, I would not tell you these things.
Yeah.
And because I'd be afraid that you would judge me.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, you're not afraid that I'm going to judge you now, you know, but it's not, I mean, you know, it's like,
it's just the way you said that, you said like, what makes you think I'm not judging?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. No, but you know, like, so why do you think you automatically assume because I am a woman that I'm going to be more open-minded, mm-hmm. more compassionate, more empathetic, and you automatically assume that a male therapist won't be those things.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting how that works. One-on-one, I think men prefer female.
I think
therapists.
That it is the group setting. I think mm-hmm. you're right that it is different,
which is weird, but
yeah.
All
right. To wrap up that's for today, show. That's yeah. our show. If you enjoyed this episode, please share with friends and family.
And don't forget to follow the show's Instagram for updates on new episodes at just_mental_health_podcast. We record a new episode every week. This is Stephanie.
This is Emily signing off. Thanks for listening.